manufacturer lab at IHCD, the Institute for Human-Centered Design here in Boston. It's an international consulting and education nonprofit that does most of its work in the Boston area, but has a presence in the universal design community across the globe. My executive director is currently in Japan and was in Switzerland earlier, and so she's all over. I'm very new at this role. I've been at the Institute for about a month now, so I can try to answer some questions, but I might not know all the answers. I got to know IHCD because I was a user expert. Part of the Institute's role is that they act as consultants for other organizations or companies to evaluate products, facilities, websites, designs, buildings, you name it, for accessibility and for meeting universal design standards. And they bring in user experts to help in that evaluation. And user experts are people like you and me who, with a variety of different lived experiences, a variety of functional limitations, such as being visually impaired or blind, or who have a broken leg, or who had a heart attack last month and are currently using a wheelchair, any number of things, to be the experts on evaluating a product. And so depending on the project, we bring in 5 or 10 folks to help evaluate it. And so I'm here today, I guess, to tell you a little bit about IHCD, see if anyone has heard of it before, and recruit some folks to be user experts for us, because we're always looking for new blood, so to speak.
Why did you go there in the first place?
I came on as a user expert, and I did, probably in the last year, helped them evaluate about 15 websites and a few random things, like I sat on a park bench and told them whether I thought it was comfortable, and played with a whisk and said whether I thought I could whisk some eggs with it, and all sorts of things. The websites are certainly the more intensive thing that I've participated in as a user expert, because when I'm using a Mac device, I use their built-in Zoom function, and sometimes I'll use their VoiceOver. And oftentimes, like, web developers have little kinks in their code that the VoiceOver will trip over. And so helping the institution point out those errors in the code or and whatnot. And now my role as a staff member at the institution is to bring other people on board to do the review for us. And then I get half the joy and the privilege of writing up the report and doing all that fun stuff. So I am about, how old am I now? 26 years old. I've been in Boston for about 5 years. I grew up in Long Island, New York. I was born with an underdeveloped optic nerve and a nystagmus and underdeveloped optic nerve, as in I have optic nerve hypoplasia. So I'm considered legally blind. About 2 years ago, I received my first guide dog. Her name is Obella. She's a German Shepherd guide dog from Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation in Connecticut. I came to Massachusetts to attend Gordon College. I moved to Boston my senior year at Gordon to do my student teaching. I was a secondary ed and history major, and I wanted to do my student teaching in an urban setting because I knew that as I got older, I'd want to be more independent, and I knew that that meant that I would probably have to live in an urban setting in order to be able to navigate the world a little better. Little did I know, the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority isn't exactly independent living sufficient all the time, but hopefully we won't have too many bad snowstorms this winter and I can actually go places. So I spent about 2 years doing my student teaching and some substitute teaching, and decided the education world was too full of politics for me. So I went into the youth development and community development field and spent about 3 years at an organization called the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Roxbury. And I helped to run a mentoring program for teenagers there and did some fundraising and development work for them. And then I came just a month ago, came to IHCD full time. And so IHCD, the Institute for Human-Centered Design, was founded almost 40 years ago as an organization called Adaptive Environments with the mission of making the world a more inclusive place. And fundamental elements of the institution's philosophy is that people aren't disabled, that their environments disable them. And it is the power of good design to remove the barriers in our environments that disable us. And that functional limitation, when somebody is functionally, whether again you're blind or visually impaired or deaf or pregnant or you're pushing a baby stroller, you know, there's functions that are harder to do. When that meets a environmental factor, when that intersection, that's when disability happens. It is not special when somebody has a functional limitation. It is something that happens to everybody at some point in their life. And so it is the institution's mission to promote good design in order to remove those barriers for everybody and really make the world a more inclusive place so that everybody can, you know, live their best self and those barriers that create disability are removed. And the language they use around that is universal design, human-centered design, which is the idea that if you boil something down to a really good design, it will work for everybody, regardless of who they are, what limitations they have or don't have, or what their life experiences have been. And so we do that in a variety of ways. We have a lot of training and workshops and things that we do with companies and nonprofits and cities and towns. We also, out of the Institute for Human-Centered Design's office, one of our projects is running the New England ADA Center. And so there are people who answer the phones to help troubleshoot situations with people with disabilities or with cities or towns or companies who have questions about the ADA law. And then we also do education work just about raising awareness about universal design and some of our philosophies and beliefs. And then we have this consulting branch where companies and towns and museums and universities will contract us to do reviews or consult on projects in order to make them more accessible. And how we sort of work with places is say, like, okay, well, at the bottom rung of this ladder that will eventually bring us to universal design, at the bottom rung is compliance. You have to comply with the Americans for Disabilities Act. You have to. We will help you get there if you're not there already. And then if you take a next step on the rung of that ladder, you've met compliance. Now let's take it a step further. Let's be a little more inclusive. Let's be a little bit more accessible to more people. Let's take a broader approach to some of the standards in the ADA. And that final rung on this ladder is the idea of universal design, that it's not about the standards, it's not about just doing what you're supposed to do, it's about how do we actually meet everybody where they're at? How do we make this teapot usable for everybody? And so my role in that, in the big picture of the Institute for Human-Centered Design, is to help do some of the, coordinate some of the educational pieces. So when universities come and ask for a lecture, I can help set up, do some of the coordinating of that. And then I recruit folks to come help evaluate products and websites and facilities. We're doing a review of the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority's new beta website. It's and still needs a lot of work, so lots of work to happen there. There's a few museums that we have contracts with, and we're working on websites or reviewing some of their exhibits. We're contracted with the Department of Conservation and Recreation to do some reviews of park facilities around Massachusetts. And so those are like actual facilities or the trails at the Blue Hills.
Did you do the Braille Trail in Watertown?
The Braille Trail in Watertown has been around for a long time now, and I just found it a year ago or so, but I don't think we had a particular role in that. I think that was mostly done by Perkins.
The current one is actually pretty new.
Yeah.
I think there was one a long time ago, but this one is a a self-guided braille, I mean, a rope-guided trail
rope,
and some
right.
other things. So it'd be an interesting one to take a look at.
We sometimes will like reach out to organizations and say, hey, we think you want us to evaluate this thing for you. But most of the time, due to funding, we have to sort of wait for them to approach us and say, like, hey, we have some money to evaluate this. Our user experts are paid. So the expectation is that, you know, your time and expertise and experiences is valuable, and so you should get paid for providing that service to these companies or places. So usually you get stipended about $20, $25. If it's a longer chunk of time or there's a lot of travel required, you know, we compensate beyond that.
I'm curious to know, how do you evaluate your user experts to make sure they really are experts?
Element of our philosophy is that everybody is an expert at living their life.
Yeah.
Your life experience is expertise enough to help make this product, this thing, better than it already is. If there are design barriers for you to be able to use this thing or interact with this place, then it's not universally designed and we have to do it differently.
So what is your staff like there, the people who are actually on board? What kind of backgrounds do they have?
Yeah, so I'm an anomaly at the organization. I have no design experience whatsoever. I don't know the language. I'm always asking them to define things for me. So I have an education background, a youth development background. Most of the staff have some kind of interdisciplinary design or technology background. So we have we have an industrial designer, we have 5 or 6 architects on staff, we have people who have been in public administration in the ADA world for a long time. We have a couple of like programmers and developers, at least 2 programmers on staff, who help me every time I'm having an HTML problem.
Okay, you're doing the MBTAs, you're evaluating their website now.
Yes.
And so you're going to write up a report to them. Are you going to tell them actually, you know, how to go in and fix these issues in terms of, you know, this violates WCAG 3.7?
Yes.
That kind of thing?
Yes.
So you make suggestions on what they need to do to fix it, not just...
I mean, what they need to do and how to do it?
Yes. Yeah, so I don't know how to do it,
right.
But I'll compile. So we had 5 folks come in and help us as user experts review the website. And so I sat there frantically taking notes about everything they said and did. And I wrote up a report giving the MBTA a profile of these users and saying, like, here are all the obstacles and things that didn't work. Here's what worked well. And then my coworker, whose name is Woody, who's our developer who's currently there, our other developers on maternity leave, he then completed the report by saying, be more specific, like, that you didn't meet, I wrote in the report, like, the blue font, the light blue font on the dark blue font was hard to see. He wrote it like, this light blue font is this percentage contrast to the dark blue font. You have to bring it up to this percentage. And he'll pull up the code and show them it, you know, in the code.
Obviously, you consider everyone an expert. But some people are better at using their screen readers than others.
Correct.
And so the question is this an access issue, or is this an issue where somebody is not using their screen reader technology to the maximum amount in order to... you know, figure this out.
We had one gentleman came in to help us review the MBTA website. And so to give you a big picture too, so for our MBTA website review, and we just did a little review recently and we'll do another set of reviews soon. We had 5 people come in. One person was totally blind. One person had dyslexia. One person was 65 years old or older. He was actually 72 years old and really just had mobility challenges. We had one person who had an autism spectrum disorder, and then one person who is in recovery from a traumatic brain and spinal cord injury. We try to bring a variety of people into the conversation because in order to get a variety of perspectives. And I, as a visually impaired person, often bring that perspective into the conversation, you know, more, and I don't necessarily understand the needs or experiences of a, you know, the gentleman who's 72 years old and really has a hard time using the trackpad. And so for him, we ran into a lot of challenges around, like, he was struggling with, like, even just how to use the computer interface. And so that was a thing we wrestle with a little bit in this digital age around, is the design of the website or the application the problem, or is it the knowledge of using the hardware? Is that the problem? So we do wrestle with that a little bit. I don't know how they reconcile it exactly, but it's a learning and growing experience, I guess, for everybody.
Do you have a screen reader user on full time there?
No, we just bring user experts in, because we also, like, you know, we had this one screen reader gentlemen come in to review the MBTA website this time around. We'll probably ask somebody different to come in the second time around, because their use of a screen reader is even going to be different than his, right? You know, he's a young guy. He's even younger than I am. He's, you know, what we would call, like, a technology native, right? And so that even brings an element to those situations. And so we try to vary it a lot of times.
Curious about the Institute. How are you funded?
We have a large grant from the federal government in order to run the New England ADA Center. And so the New England ADA Center and that education and technical assistance branch of the organization is funded that way, through the Americans for Disabilities Act money pocket, wherever they get it from, our tax dollars, you know. The rest of the organization is consultants. So the MBTA has contracted us to do this review, and so we bill them our hours and expenses for the review, and they pay for it. When we come to MIT and do a talk with their students, MIT gives us an honorarium for doing that. So the rest of our organization's budget is really contracted and sort of piecemeal.
So if somebody wants to be a user expert, wants to be on the list for potentially being one, what should they do?
A Word document, for those who, that's the most accessible way. And that gives you a little bit of an overview of what the User Expert program is, and there's a link in there to sign up. We have an application. It's not like you get accepted or you don't. It's just I need your information, obviously, to contact you and for when I'm writing my reports and whatnot. And then once you fill out the application, I'll contact you and let you know, oh, I got it. Maybe I need you to fill out a little more paperwork. A lot of times for our projects, we ask user experts to fill out non-disclosure agreements or media release waivers or liability waivers. So sometimes I have other paperwork to fill out. And then it's sort of just depends on what projects we have going on. I'll give you a call or an email and say, hey, can we schedule time for you to come review this thing? So there's an application. It's a Google form, pretty straightforward. I've tested our form with a bunch of different screen readers, so it seems to be working okay. And then you'll just be in direct contact with me for scheduling reviews and whatnot. I can give you my email address if you have a way to take it down today, and you can just email me and be in touch directly. My email is mustendesign.org. Most of the time we don't ask the users to write the reports. We observe their evaluation of the product and I write the reports. Yeah, so there's a lot less writing. If you're doing a remote review, you might have more writing to do, but they're always optional. So I'll tell you, like, if you want to do this remotely, I'm going to need you to do a little bit more writing because I'm not physically there to take the notes and get the information I need to do your writing. One of the philosophies of the Institute is that in our ideal world that we're striving for, there should be less need for assistive technology and more of that in more access embedded into the digital world that we're slowly but surely expanding on. So the idea that totally blind person should be able to sit down at any computer and interact with anything without having to have their own screen reader and their own anything, right? Like, that would be the perfect world, right? Like, and if you want to talk with an institute that's a little bit more on our tech world, I'm happy to, you know, shoot me an email, look at us, give us a call. I'm happy to put you in touch with more tech-savvy individuals. I'm not always the best answerer of those kind of questions, but we have folks who are.
Well, thank you very much.